Hello, and welcome to the Classicist Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Sinek, here with Victor Davis Hanson, the Martin and Ely Anderson Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution. And Victor, as you and I are taping this, we're still in the midst of the government shutdown, which stems from a struggle over whether President Trump will or will not get his way on having a border wall with Mexico. And you wrote a piece recently for National Review about the immigration dynamic with Mexico and some of the ironies that stem from it. And I'll start with this datum from your piece, that a recent poll revealed that more than one-third of Mexicans, so this is the equivalent of about 44 million people, would like to immigrate to the United States, from which you in this piece make a number of observations, the first of which is that this is somewhat strange in that there's nothing that makes Mexico an inherently miserable place. It's actually pretty blessed with resources. Explain that.
Well, it's in the top 10, or in some studies, the top, it's 12 in the world's listing of oil production nations. So it's got a lot of oil. It's got really good farmland. It's one of those rare countries that has a coast on both the Atlantic and the Pacific Ocean. It's sort of the gateway between Latin America and North America. So its geography, location is wonderful. It's rich in all sorts of natural. The question is, why would one-third of the population, well over 44 million people, want to leave a country that's so rich? And the answer, of course, is that it's economic, social, cultural, political, and economic regimen are not fully Western, and by that I mean there's statism, there's not gender equity, there's not tolerance of dissent, there's not a Bill of Rights, there's not a transparent government, there's not property rights that have been Westernized, and the result is that despite all of that natural bounty, they just cannot produce goods and services to the degree to keep their own people home. And in that article, I suggested maybe 11 to 13 million. I was using the 22 million new study of illegal aliens in the United States by the Yale MIT scholars, and suggested that the usual figure of about 56% would make it about somewhere between 11 and 12 million or 13 million of all illegal aliens are from Mexico.
So economists and social scientists like to talk about the difference between what they call stated demand and revealed demand, which in layman's terms is the difference between what you say you want and what your actions demonstrate that you actually want. And along those lines, you say in this piece there's a big difference between how progressives, who often sympathize with illegal immigration, talk about how the United States treats immigrants and what the actions of immigrants actually show us about the character of the United States. Explain that for us.
Well, we know that people from those four targeted countries in Central America, Honduras, Salvador, Guatemala, Salvador, and not so much Nicaragua, but those countries, when they come northward, they don't go to Mexico, even though the culture is similar, the language is nearly identical. But they come to the United States, and yet they've been imbued with an endemic propaganda that says the Yankees up north are racist, they're anti-Catholic, they're anti-Spanish, they're anti-indigenous people. And when they approach the borders, we saw in these clips of the so-called caravan, people throw rocks, they wave their national flags of Guatemala or Honduras or Nicaragua or Salvador. And it doesn't make sense. It's almost as if, well, if you want to leave your country, why not go to Mexico? But if Mexico also has solidarity with people of the same ethnic background and language, then Mexico should say, because they do believe in open borders, apparently are open borders, they should welcome them in, especially because there's a manpower shortage in Oaxaca State, given so many people have left the United States. But what we're seeing, as you point out, between the dream and the reality, there's a huge abyss, because people demonstrating on that side of the border against the United States. And then when we have immigration rallies on this side, they're not covered with American flags often. They're covered with Mexican flags. And we hear all these accusations the United States is xenophobic, racist, nativist, protectionist, xenophobic. But behind that entire construct is the fact that the United States takes in more legal and illegal immigrants in any country in the world, and almost as much as everyone put together. So something, there's some disconnect there. And I think the disconnect is that people, Spanish-speaking immigrants from south of the border, believe that the United States is an equal opportunity society. It does not privilege race or tribalism. It's more meritocratic than their own governments are. And there's more opportunity for somebody who comes across the border with an eighth grade education, no English, no legality, than there is to be a full-fledged citizen in a Spanish-speaking country. And yet, what I just said would drive most people crazy in on the left side of the debate.
So, as I mentioned at the top of the show, we're in the middle of this showdown over the border wall. And as someone who'd like to see reform to the system and a crackdown on illegal immigration, give us a sense of how large the wall looms in your own thinking. Do you think of this as a necessary condition of cracking down on illegal immigration? If so, is it also a sufficient one? And are there other factors that you think of as significant, maybe something like E-Verify, for instance, to really get serious about cracking down on illegal immigration?
Well, I think we authorized the Security Fence Act of 2006, and that's from which we get those clips of Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid all weighing in that they supported it. And that was supposed to build over 800 miles. That was the easiest 800 miles that has the most traffic. We only built about 600. Of the 2,000-mile border, most people believe that there's about 500 miles that have natural obstacles, big sheer cliffs that wouldn't necessarily, or the Rio Grande is deeper, but we wouldn't really need to build a wall. So I'm thinking about, I think most people think about 1,400 miles would really help. Now, are drones or electronic surveillance, is E-Verify, are those necessary? Yes, but remember, they haven't stopped the influxes. If surveillance worked, electronic surveillance, sensors, and right now drones worked, and E-Verify worked, and there was no illegal immigration, then the proponents of open borders would be saying something like, this is racist, this is eavesdropping, this is intrusion to privacy, this is forcing employers to play the part of ICE. Why don't we just build a wall? Because they think the wall wouldn't work. And so their opposition to the wall is not because it represents some medieval construct or retrograde solution. Their criticism is that it works, and they do not want closed border, because a closed border means then that instead of 45 million people who were not born in the United States now living in the United States, within 20 years you might have 2 or 3 million instead of somewhere between, I don't know, 12 and 20 million illegal aliens, you might have 2 or 300,000. And that would mean that the people who are here who had green cards would assimilate, intermarry, and integrate. And that all put together would mean that, as in the case of Cubans, then there might be avenues for Latino Americans to follow the traditional route of Cuban Americans or Italian Americans. I'm speaking again of people from impoverished areas that were Catholic, and they tend to be as conservative, or not more so conservative than liberal. And so that's what the whole, that's the subtext of the whole debate. The progressive movement saw California, they saw Nevada, they saw New Mexico, and they see Colorado and Arizona and Texas. And they feel that they can achieve through demography what they can't through their political appeal.
The president, when he gave his speech recently from the Oval Office on immigration, invoked some of the crime committed by illegal immigrants. Didn't make these stories up. We have fairly high visibility murders on a pretty regular basis, including a few regularly. But any time that these sorts of stories are invoked, you will hear a chorus of response in the media that, well, in reality, immigrants actually commit crime at a far lower level than native-born citizens, as if that's basically the end of the discussion. How do you react to that line, Victor, which is so often invoked in those kinds of conversations?
Well, we know there was 250,000 illegal aliens in the last 24 months that were booked for crimes. We know the IRS said in the last 4 years there was 1 million people who engaged in identity theft and fraud. So when they give those statistics, first of all, it's very hard to distinguish legal from illegal immigrants. And then we know that about a third of federal prisoners can be, and most studies show, are illegal aliens. So then we have state, local jails and prisons. It's very hard to get all accurate documents. So my conclusion is there should be no crimes, because somebody who's asking to be a guest should be of exemplary behavior, better than what you have. Otherwise, why would you let him in the front door? And then second, there's absolutely no way to monitor what a crime is. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. So 2 weeks ago, somebody dropped a spray rig that was stripped. And there was a lot of Mexican newspapers, food all around it, where people had partied and tried to take apart a spray rig. Or the other day, three people came into my yard, none of them who spoke English. Do I know if they're legal? I don't. I don't know if they're legal, but I have an assumption that they seem to be from Oaxaca, and they spoke a kind of a funny Spanish. And they had been digging holes looking for what they said were truffles. I don't think they exist here, but they were destroying a lot of these cypress trees I had. These are just the everyday thing. If people who downplay the collateral damage of illegal immigration just had one time their identity stolen. I have. I woke up one day and there were $9,000 missing from my checking account. Somebody had gone to a local Mexican food market. Somebody had taken the router number. They had printed checks with their name, address, phony, of course, and another little market, and then with a router number of my checks on there. So when I looked at my canceled checks, here was 15 checks, all from somebody else with a different phony name, phony address. I don't think that ever gets reported. I didn't report it. I just went to the bank and they said, whatever it is, we'll pay for it. So with illegal immigration, there's a huge number of crimes in addition to those that are reported. And we had Officer Singh 100 miles from where I'm speaking in Newmark was killed. But even more gruesome was Gustavo Garcia right before Christmas, who was a twice deported illegal alien, two felony counts, arrested, let out of jail because of sanctuary cities without notifying ICE. Mr. Garcia got out of jail. He went to Walmart. He stole bullets for his gun. He had two accomplices. We don't know where they are. And then he went on a rampage. He shot farm workers. He shot his ex-girlfriend. He went into a local fast food mart service station. He shot and killed somebody. Then he got into a car and he ran off four cars and he shot another person. When it was all said and done, Mr. Garcia, who ended up killing himself by wrecking his car, put seven people in the hospital and murdered three people, two of whom were Hispanic. And so this is the world that we live in if you don't live behind a big wall in Malibu, or you don't live in Atherton, or you're not Mark Zuckerberg, or you're not Barbara Streisand. So there's a class element that the reason people are so upset about it is they deal firsthand with it. And they don't want to hear that somebody is a Rhodes Scholar. That happens. But their attitude is, we don't want 10% of 14 to 20 million people committing crimes. We don't want any percent of them. We want people to come meritocratic, diverse, measured, and with English facilities. And anybody that didn't want that, you have to ask, why would they want people not to come to the United States knowing English on a meritocratic basis, a diverse from all over the world pool, and in numbers that we can integrate? And the answer is because it's the only way they can create a huge democratic constituency.
And that's the whole story. It's not, and it's, I know that they don't want to give Trump a victory. I know there's people arguing back and over the wall, but the bottom line is they do not want the border to be sealed. They believe that Trump will seal it and the wall will pretty much seal it. And then that's the end of their flipping all these states that have been so successful.
So the final question I'll put to you is on this point you just raised about the kind of people we do want. How should we think about our goals when it comes to assimilating immigrants? And here's what I mean by that. There are certain basics that I think most people agree on. You want immigrants to be able to speak English. You want them to have some baseline grasp of American civics, obviously be law-abiding, et cetera, et cetera. But beyond that, it gets a little murkier. America is full of ethnic neighborhoods, of ethnic cuisine, of families that still continue many traditions from their home countries. That doesn't seem to be an enormous cause for concern. So if we don't define assimilation as conformity, how do we define it? What are the key variables, I guess, that distinguish between the salad bowl and the melting pot?
Well, it's what it always has been. The core of a person's existence is American. By that, I mean he speaks English. He follows all the rules. He comes out of the shadows. He gets a regular driver's license. He does not require court reporting in Spanish. He doesn't go to the DMV and demand that he have a special language. You don't, you know, call into a government agency and have to put six buttons for six different languages. But what he does in his own private life enhances America. I mean, food, as you said, cuisine, fashion, music. These are all the adornments that surround a Western core of constitutional government, private property, free market economics, all the things that people don't have in Mexico or most elsewhere in the world. But if you come here and you reverse that and you say that the adornments or the satellite culture is going to be the core culture, and you don't feel that you have to come, first thing you do when you enter the United States is break the law, and the second thing you do is break the law by residing here illegally. And then you say, I need this, and I want you to give me that, and I need legal help, I need educational help, I need linguistic help, I need financial help, I need medical help. And it's about $84,000 per illegal immigrant, and we have 30% of all Medi-Cal births that are 50% of all California births are to people who are here illegally. But when you have that attitude, that's not a good start for an American. And that's what people are upset about, because this entitlement idea of people who are foreign nationals who say to us, even though I'm not yet in your country, I have a right because of family connections or because Mexico used to own parts of the United States or because you're racist, whatever. We've heard all of those various complaints. I have a right to come into your country before anybody from Kenya or South Korea or the Ukraine. And once I'm in here, you owe me something. And if you don't give it to me, you're racist. And what I would like to see the dialogue be flipped and say to the illegal immigrant and his handlers is, you're racist. Because what you're doing is you're saying that immigration should not be diverse. It should be overwhelmingly from Central America and Mexico. And that's not fair to people, and it's not what America's based on. And then you're saying that when a person flies in, a U.S. citizen, and he loses his passport, he's in a world of trouble at the airport. But that's not going to be applicable to you. You don't need a passport. You just walk right in. And when an American citizen like you or I forges our name or gives an improper Social Security number or creates an identity, then we have felonies on our record and we're done for. And so we have to apply these same rules to people who come in and change our definition of ethical immigration. What we have right now is unethical. And it's kind of, to be frank, it's chauvinistic. It's kind of racist because the Hispanic community and the people in Mexico and Central America are saying, we have claims on your country and can come into your country in a way that people from other countries who are waiting legally don't have. So that's just the way it's going to be for you. And by the way, we would never treat immigrants trying to come into our countries the way you would, because we don't believe in tolerance and we believe in legal immigration. So Mexico is saying to us, we have elements in our constitution that doesn't want to impair the racial essence of Mexico through immigration. But you are racist and for not having that, I guess. So I guess this asymmetry is really driving a lot of Americans crazy, that if we treated immigrants from south of the border the way that Mexico or Honduras or Salvador or Guatemala does, then I don't know what they would think of us if we just acted the way they do to their immigrants. And it's almost Orwellian, and I think it's getting people really angry when they think about it, because it's so absurd. It's just a particular canon of law that says we're going to suspend and nullify all federal laws pertaining to people only south of the border. But so if you come in from Ghana and you just think you're going to fly in without a passport, sorry, you're going to be gone. Or if you think you're going to go to Mexico City and come in across the border and you're from Ghana, we'll probably deport you. But not if you're Mexican or South American or Central American. Now, I think that's not a sustainable proposition.
All right. You've been listening to the Classicist Podcast with Victor Davis Hanson. Remember, you can read Victor's work at Defining Ideas at hoover.org, as well as at victorhanson.com. And if you enjoy the Classicist, please rate the show on iTunes. For Victor Davis Hanson, I'm Troy Sinek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.